We want to build a community and share other women's stories.
Everyone, and welcome to the Tea with TE She Who Leads podcast. Today is a very interesting session. I have got Sarah Grice with me, who is the Group Head of Talent and Interim Head of DE&I at Barclays. Sarah, thanks so much for joining and welcome.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
I will let everybody just learn a little bit about you. So let's just start with a quick introduction in terms of background and career, if that's okay.
Yeah, no problem. So I've worked in HR for a number of decades. I used to say 20 plus years, but I have to say it's probably closer to 30 plus years now, which is really scary. I've worked in a number of different industries. It's one of the reasons I love HR. It's really transferable. So started life in retail, then moved on to sell HR services as a consultant. But I've really spent the last couple of decades in banking. I've also had the opportunity to live and work in a number of geographies and traveled extensively with a number of jobs I've had. So spent 5 years out in Singapore, which was a great experience. And I'm now back in London, equally having a great experience. The types of work I've done have largely been generalist HR roles, either managing regions or globally. But in the last 4 years, I've specialised, starting with talent management, but then I expanded to resourcing. And as you said, recently moved to Barclays, where I've added learning and now DEI. So one of the things I love about HR and my job is doing the things I do know, but also trying some things that I don't. It's a really great way to learn and grow. So spent the majority of my career at Standard Chartered Bank, but as we've said there, 9 months ago, took the plunge to move to a new organisation, Barclays, and absolutely loving a new challenge in a new context.
Sounds like you have already achieved a lot with a lot more to come, I imagine. Let's just touch upon that a little bit, because obviously you have managed to live and travel in a lot of different places. How I'll let you talk about where that was, but how was that time and how did it, I guess there's a lot that you learn from being in different cultures and how did that shape your thinking and alignment to being quite DEI focused?
Yeah, it's a great question actually. And it's one of these things I've heard other people talk about and it felt quite academic. And then having done it, it's a real sort of visceral learning experience. So traveled extensively in Africa and Asia, but as I said, had the opportunity to take my whole family. So two small boys and a husband and a mother-in-law to Singapore and lived there for 5 years. And because I don't like to do things by halves, I wasn't just moving location. I was also moving to a very different job. It was the first big global job I had. It was the first time I'd moved from supporting the front office in the bank to technology and operations. So lots of different learnings. But to answer your question, my experience in Singapore was a really eye-opening. So firstly, for some context, Singapore's a really multicultural environment. It's got a kind of rich blend of Chinese, Malay, Indian, but also Western influences. And that's really evident when you look at the food, the language, actually the array of cultural festivals that you get to take part in. And what it really taught me was the importance of, I guess, valuing that cultural diversity, recognising the positive impact it brings, but also it really made me think through the need for cultural sensitivity and how I've been brought up in the UK with a huge amount of Western influences, and I assume that was the kind of the way that you did things. And then you move and it's almost like you're standing in someone else's shoes. You absolutely look at the world and the way that you work, the way that you lead, the way that you engage teams in quite a different way. So absolutely loved it and learned huge amounts.
Yeah, I'm sure. I didn't realise that your mother-in-law got to go along for the journey as well. That's nice.
Yeah, and the funny thing was, we actually then came back with the mother-in-law, with the two children who are a lot older, and my husband. But we also rescued a dog in Singapore we fell in love with. Aww. So it's really funny when I was talking to someone about the arrangement, she said, "You're the only person that's come back with an extended more, family.
More family.
Yes.
Your dog must have two passports.
He's very confused. He does miss the heat. You laugh. He actually does still have all his paperwork from Singapore. So yes.
Wow. I mean, that's the epitome of kind of building bridges across different cultures, right? But how nice as well that you could bring him back. Yes. And that must have been a challenge. So first global role, thinking about going into APAC, obviously completely new country with young children as well. So that must have been something that did shape your career. And obviously in this podcast, we like to help share those moments that did help people along the way. Were there any other kind of pivotal moments in your career that you can point to?
So it's a great question, actually, isn't it? I think it's how we should probably shape all of our CVs. It'd be much more interesting. So I've talked about Asia. A couple of others I would pull out. And actually, I'm going to go right back to my first ever job after graduating. So I joined the Marks & Spencer's graduate training scheme, and it's a general management scheme. And I'd not really heard of HR at that point. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we're going back so far that it was called personnel. So I joined the scheme. And in my mind, I was going to learn how to be a commercial manager. And you do rotations. So I did my commercial management, managing a store, age 21, which is quite scary. Did the financials so I could recite my P&L and I could talk to anyone around the products and what the value was. But then I moved to the personnel rotation. And it was like something all clicked. I can't kind of quite describe it, but I got really excited about the work that we were doing. And I could see how that was going to drive the commercials and the financials. And I don't want to offend any of my colleagues that are commercial or finance managers, but it was way more interesting. Mm-hmm. And I really kind of understood the difference that getting people decisions right or actually getting them wrong can have mm-hmm. on a culture.
Yeah.
And that's what the reason I would pull that out as pivotal is if I hadn't had that kind of moment, I may have gone down quite a different path. So that was really, really pivotal. One other that comes to mind as well, and it's more around kind of people taking chances on you, bets on you. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, I'd gone on maternity leave with my first son, and I was thinking about sort of returning to work and having all of the usual conversations with yourself that you do around, can I do this? How will I juggle? And my boss at the time rang me and said she was moving to Dubai and would I like to be considered for her role? And my instinct was, oh, I'm not ready. But she absolutely invested the time in saying, actually, we think you're ready for these reasons. This is how we'll support you. And it was absolutely the right thing. I was ready for their next challenge.
Yeah.
But again, it was a real pivotal moment because if she hadn't invested that time in me and built mm-hmm. my confidence, I think I probably would have been a bit more cautious mm-hmm. and I'd have missed out on a great opportunity. So kind of my top tip for anyone is, you know, when someone does invest in you and take that chance, go for it. What have you got to lose, really?
Yeah, 100%. And I think on that topic, I do think as women, we probably, and there's those statistics, right, around women actually holding themselves back versus men always going for the thing that's probably one or two levels above. And I don't know why that is kind of a systemic thought process around how we operate, but it's so common. And I agree. I think we have to just take the leap.
Agreed. I always sort of talk about that voice in your head, which I still have, but you kind of come up with coping mechanisms that, you know, I kind of almost wish I could say to myself 20 years ago, you do not need to have nailed everything before you then can move to the next stage.
Yeah.
It has to be a kind of, I think, a 70-30 rule that you apply that says, you know what, I could probably do 60 to 70% of that next role. But some of it, I think I've got the skills and the potential, but I'm going to have to learn as I go. And almost being a bit more relaxed with that, I think is important, but it is hard to do.
Yeah. And it's a bit like you just mentioned with taking that first global role that obviously you'd never done in a different country and then kind of moving into this broader talent and then DEI role you've not necessarily had before, but you've leaned on. Of course, you understand the premise and it will relate to your role, but without kind of going, do you know what, I feel like I'm ready and I can go for it, you can't get the experience either. And so it is that you, unless you take the chance, I think you will stay in the same place for longer, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I learned, and actually my last boss helped me with this, is you don't, it doesn't have to be binary. So actually she had a conversation with me. I was largely an HR generalist, as I said, and I'd never really thought I'd moved into what HR calls centers of expertise, the sort of the specialist pieces, because I felt like you needed to have done that for 20 odd years. Utterly ridiculous voice in my head. But my boss said to me, look, alongside your generalist role, why don't we add one aspect of talent, see how that feels, try it out. And I actually thought that was a really good technique, because you sort of build your confidence, but you're not having to kind of make the decision to go all in. And then you can go all in. So a little bit of try before you buy, I think,
is a good way to trial and error. You can see if you like it as well, right? So you may not have even thought about going down a more specialist avenue. Unless you're trying it, you don't know if you're going to get there. One thing I think a lot of female leaders in particular do talk more about is the importance of networking and sponsorship. And I think you described it to me when we first spoke around having this scaffolding around you, which I really, really like that concept. Who have you had along the way? And do you mind talking a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, it's really interesting. So people talk about build your network, and it always used to not really resonate with me, because I had these awful visions of walking into kind of a party and having to talk to people I didn't know. And that was my impression of networking. So it's not my word. I've sort of borrowed it from somebody I worked with a little while ago. But I actually think that's what you're looking to do with sponsorship, mentorship, is build that scaffolding around you that equips you to take that leap or to do those things that you wouldn't. So I've definitely acquired a number of people that are part of my scaffolding over the years. And they're people outside of my day-to-day work. I may have worked with them in the past, but they're my safe space. So they're my place that I can go and test out all those voices in my head if I'm sort of having one of those moments. But they'll also hold the mirror up to me and challenge me. And sometimes tell me not to be so silly and stupid. And actually, one of the things that I've noticed is you get more senior in your career, it's harder and harder for people to honestly do that. Even when you create, you try and create a safe space and open environment. So you almost need more of a scaffolding, I think, as you get more senior, so that A, it's a safe space, but B, they will definitely hold that mirror up. So it's all about getting different perspectives, I think, and challenge. Otherwise you can get a little bit comfortable and not realize actually what where you need to go next.
And do you feel like having a diverse network is beneficial?
No, definitely. And as I sort of talked about earlier, the great thing about HR is people are people, and yes, different industries, there are slight nuances, but I love the fact that in my scaffolding setup, I have people that work in completely different industries, and I find that really refreshing. Clearly I feel a lot of contacts in Asia, and I continue to keep in touch, because again, that gives you those perspectives. And then I'd include my own family. I've got now 16 and 18 year old boys who will absolutely keep me honest about where I'm at and grounded, and I actually think that's super helpful as well. So yes, I think diverse range of perspectives is the best way to continue to learn and grow.
And a lot of people, especially senior leaders, and you kind of alluded that to that there, will say to me that actually the further up the chain you go, the lonelier it is. And so how can you think about to pull in? I guess you have to think outside, either outside of your immediate organization, being HR, or kind of broader. How do you think about that as you do go up the chain?
Yeah, look, it can feel lonely, because you know, I see some leaders who feel they have to sort of burden everything and hold things back. I've learned over the years that transparency to an extent is really important. So you know, if you need to solve a problem, I can guarantee you're never going to do it well on your own. You need to bring others with you. But as a leader, there's that balance, which I don't want to pass all of the issues and stress down the chain, because I need to contain some of that, but I do need to share the problem. I think my role as the leader is to really define the problem as clearly as possible, filter out where is it noise from a problem, and then I think it is less lonely, because actually you're doing it together as opposed to finishing doing it on your own. However, you know, back to the scaffolding, on top of what I talked about, I do try and regularly engage in forums, listen to podcasts, find other ways, because actually I find that really reassuring, because 9 times out of 10, you recognise you're not dealing with these problems on your own.
Yeah.
You know, a number of people are working through the same issues. I think when we went through COVID, that was a great example of, I saw many HR functions across the world comparing notes rapidly.
Oh yeah.
So I think that's another way of feeling less lonely, actually, and isolated.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And then thinking about kind of these networks and diversity more broadly, I know that having a diverse network probably does make you think about how you approach diversity within your own organization. But I'd love to get into kind of talent, the process, I guess, around kind of how you are creating processes when we're thinking a lot around talent. And I'm sure there's a lot that we can go into here. But would you say that different leadership styles as a starting point have influenced your perspective in terms of thinking about DE&I?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think the first, and yeah, look, there's lots on, I could probably spend the rest of the podcast talking about process.
We probably will.
But don't worry, I won't. I think I realised a number of years ago that there is not a model leader. So I'm going to probably make lots of people that have developed leadership frameworks very upset. But I don't think there's one type of leader, actually, that I certainly don't believe they exist. If you look at all the leadership frameworks, you're not going to tick everything. I think the really sort of important learn I've had is it's the team. So as you put the leader together with the team, and then the leader is, you know, often sitting on a leadership team, so they're a member of multiple teams, it's how all that connects together to drive diversity. So I know myself, the range of skills, experiences and perspectives that I need to have on my team for me to be at my best as a leader, because I've got some strengths and I've got some areas I know are lesser strengths, as we might call them. I think you can invest a huge amount of money in leadership training, and all of that's really important, but actually it's that chemistry. I think we have to pivot more towards supporting teams and leadership teams than necessarily individuals. And then look at the context. I think there are different styles of leadership according to different contexts. COVID's a great example. It required quite a different leadership set from perhaps if you're transforming an organization. So I think context and team are two of the things that I've thought quite deeply about in this space.
Yeah. And I think there are many different thought processes around what we can do when it comes to, like you say, there's not really, yes, there's a lot of books, there's a lot of courses that we can go on. There's a lot of female leadership courses we can go on, right? But I don't think that necessarily tackles the issue. What have you encountered that has been good and positive when it comes to kind of DEI initiatives? And then what are the challenges that we think we face in that space?
Sure. No, it's a really, obviously I've been thinking quite a lot about this given my sort of recent expanded role. So things that I think are really helpful, and I would see them as hygiene factors, but they don't always happen, is firstly just setting out and agreeing some clear DEI ambitions. This is a really crowded space, so being super clear on that, and then ensuring they're not HR owned. Business has to not just pay lip service, but genuinely understand, appreciate and own why that's a good thing. And I actually think many organizations, including Barclays, have moved way beyond that. People absolutely understand the why.
Yeah.
It's the how do you then embed.
Exactly.
The tricky bit. So I think that's the first thing that I would say is super important. Have clear ambitions and then get really clear with everyone on their role in delivering them. Everybody has a role to play. So sort of being super clear on that is helpful. I do think being data and insight led is really important. To sort of keep yourself honest on, are we making the progress we said we'd make? But also using the insights to focus actions. There's a lot of activity that can happen in this space, but I'm particularly, as I'm in a very large organization, we've got almost 90,000 people. We have lots happening in this space, but actually what's the data and insight telling me about where we're making progress,
mm-hmm.
and how do I bottle that and do more of that? What is it that's making it work?
Mm-hmm.
And then where have I got hot spots where I will absolutely need to take some different actions or the same things will happen? So data and insights would sort of be the second thing. And then the third thing that I'm always really keen to do is to benchmark. This is not a unique problem for the organization you're working in. So what are other organizations doing? What could we learn from that? What hasn't worked elsewhere that we mm-hmm. could learn from? And then there's all the usual things you'd expect me to talk about from a process perspective,
mm-hmm.
whether it be recruitment or learning or mentoring or sponsorship programs. But they're the usual things when you Google this that people, but I would come back to that ambitions, data and insight, benchmarking, and almost that's a continuous loop as you mm-hmm. go through. And then I haven't said this, but patience. Some of this stuff just takes time.
Doesn't happen.
And I work in an industry that, yes, has long-term ambitions, and I'm really proud of those, but also has a desire to see, well, how are we doing quarter on quarter? So I think you do have to manage expectations mm-hmm. around if you can do this well, and it's going to be embedded, not just lip service, this will take us some time. So you have mm-hmm. to have patience, and you have to have kind of the will to stick with what we said we're going to do. So there's certainly some of the conversations we're having at Barclays.
Thank you. And you know what? It's so true around keep yourself honest. And I think there's a lot that can be said for that, because I think sometimes it is lip service. And also around, like you say, not necessarily the what or the why, because I think everybody knows why we're doing it. There should be that sense of purpose. But the actual then how do we go and do something, I think is where people struggle. When you just said about the networks and like benchmarking, obviously that links back to, I'm sure you must know who your counterparts are in the market, but just thinking that someone wants to tackle this within their own organization, what would your approach typically be there if you're thinking about then doing some benchmarking?
Yeah, I mean, actually the banking industry is really interesting at the moment, because the regulator in the UK is really dialing up focus on DEI. And actually, there was a consultation paper at the end of last year that banks have contributed to. And I think we're going to see some sort of more formal outcomes coming from that. Now, I welcome all of that, because
it's amazing.
It's another lever to pull. It's another why. But actually, the reason I raised that is the regulators gathered huge amounts of really interesting insights from a good cross-section of organizations that certainly if you're in the banking industry and you haven't heard about that, I would absolutely look at that as it comes through. And then actually some of the networking that we talked about earlier, so forums that I go to with senior HR, heads of HR or heads of talent, this is always a topic we'll exchange ideas on. I find that quite rich. And then any of the big consultancies like Mercer, for example, have just published their 2024 Talent Trends report, really extensive piece of research across all aspects of talent, but a really interesting section on DEI. And one of the reasons I like that sort of set of data is they don't just talk to HR professionals, clearly we're amazing, but they also talk to CEOs and business leaders, they talk to investors, they talk to colleagues. So it's really diverse in the way they actually pull that together. And it sometimes gives you some different thoughts and trends about what's happening and perhaps where to focus.
Yeah, amazing. And I guess really on topic here, but a lot of diversity starts with hiring. And I'd love to just explore your strategies around that. So I know you've got some great ideas that you have been bringing to the helm whilst you've been in your role at Barclays.
Sure. Yeah, look, I mean, a number of different things we're looking at. And as I said earlier, some of these we're going to have to be patient with in terms of outcomes. They're the expectations I manage with all of my stakeholders all the time. But a couple of things we're doing. So firstly, again, back to data and insight, we measure what I call the recruitment funnel. So you start at the top with everybody applying. We have millions and millions. We have over 3 million applications a year. You then decide how am I gonna long list, short list, interview process. And we measure at every aspect various different things, the experience, the efficiency, but our diverse talent pools, seeing different outcomes at any parts of those process from other talent pools. And it's really helpful. And it really helps then infer back to actions. Where might we need to take action? So as an example, when we looked at that, we saw that as female talent moves through the process, actually do as well, if not better, than other talent pools, which is great. So therefore, the problem we need to address is not the selection process. That looks fair and equitable. That's really good. But actually, we need to just find a way to attract more females into the top of the funnel, now where we're focusing on in terms of brand attraction, making sure that people understand all the great stuff that we're doing to provide that environment that is inclusive for female talent. So data and insight is definitely one of the things that we've looked at. I think the other thing we're looking at is how do we support diverse talent pools to really be at their best during the interview process, through the application process, and really provide some additional support to make sure that we're at a level playing field. And we do this quite a lot at Barclays, in particular with our early careers or our graduate talent, because that can be quite overwhelming. It's often the first time you've applied. So we partner with a number of different external partners, focus on diverse candidates, but provide those students with additional support. We host sessions on careers. We help them think about, you know, how they present their experiences and skills, just to give everybody the sort of best possible chance of going through that process in the right way. And I could go on, but they're just a couple of examples.
That's really
of things
helpful.
That we're trying.
Yeah, it's really helpful. And the policy, kind of the interesting thing around female hiring, and we see this a lot in the space that we're in. Obviously, we support quite a diverse group of clients, but I'd say with female attraction, like you say, I do think the thought process around what appeals to a working mother versus a younger female is different. But equally, how can you attract to all types of females in different situations? And I think sometimes the policies for males versus females is we're not looking at the same things.
Yeah.
And so it's how are you then? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I agree. It's really interesting. I haven't moved jobs for almost 20 years when I decided to move to Barclays, and you get sent all the usual stuff, which is great, really great set of benefits and fabulous to understand about the purpose and the culture. But I can remember flicking through all of this stuff, and what jumped out is a whole range of benefits specifically geared towards women. So for example, lots and lots of support for women going through the menopause, proper real practical support, hotlines to call, guidance, support. And I thought, actually, that in itself, that the rest are kind of almost what you'd expect, but that really sort of jumped out for me as Barclays really thought about this. That's going to be really practical. And so I think you're exactly right. Really being thoughtful about the different types of employees that we're going to have, who are going to be experiencing different things at different parts of their life. And then just making sure that's featured, I think, as a way to attract talent in, super important actually. And it's almost, it feels like a small thing, but they're really impactful actually, because it sends, I think, a message that this is important to us.
Yeah, and I think somebody that's just becoming a mother versus, as you say, somebody going through the menopause, different times in their lives, but nice to know that you've got the support before actually joining somewhere.
Yes. Yes.
Which is great. And that's really nice to hear that that's something that you've got on offer. And it's those little things, I think, that actually make huge difference. And it's hard, isn't it, when you've already got kind of a DNA of a business, and say that there's critical hires that need to be made. And so you, and this is where I think people struggle a little bit, because I think diversity kind of goes out the window when you've got speed, time to hire, you really need to get somebody. So then it becomes a male, but then you look at like your sales organization and it's all males. And so you think, how then can we actually then bring in future females? And they look at the organization and they go, well, it's all male, so why would I come in? And I do think actually the policy piece, or kind of the understanding around how it's shaped towards female hiring longer term, will help, because you can't then just unpick your team and say, actually, we need to hire a load more females and it's not working. So obviously this doesn't work like that either.
No, I completely agree. And then you're back to the, you know, you have to be patient. I also think you've particularly at senior level, you've kind of failed if you're waiting for the vacancy to open up. You really kind of need to be doing the pipelining, building the network, really challenging yourself to make sure that you're engaging with as diverse a group of talent as possible, way ahead of I've now got the vacancy. And it's quite a mindset shift actually around even what's the internal recruitment function there to do. You know, is it there to take the job requisition and fill the role, or is it completely different? And I think as we build a more sophisticated view of the skills we have, the skills we need, we can do more and more of that proactively. That's certainly where we're trying to get to in Barclays.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I think not everybody thinks in that way. You think that the talent acquisition function is to hire the talent. So that is for that immediate opportunity versus what is our future talent?
Yes.
What do we need to hire for to make sure that it's not just the people that are in the senior roles now, but what are we doing longer term?
Exactly. And I have no desire to impact your business model, but also, you know, actually, have we got this talent internally that we could grow alongside where do we need to go? So one of the things we're experimenting with in my team is we're putting together talent acquisition and learning. We call it talent development, and creating a one talent partner model so that we have on behalf of the business one role that is starting to go, okay, so here's the demand that's coming in. Actually, is this where I need to go buy that talent externally?
Yeah.
Is actually the better way to spend our money to invest in reskilling internally? Yeah. Actually, is this a contingent worker? So really a kind of whole talent solution is where we're trying to get to. It sounds wonderful. It's actually quite hard to do. So we're sort of experimenting in one area, and then we'll build from there.
Yeah. And you know what? I feel like that goes hand in hand with the patience piece, because everybody is so quick to need X person in place. So we just hire who's good for the job. Which of course, yes, we need the people that are good for the job, but equally, are we thinking about how that is an equitable future of this organization? One thing that we do, and I think it sounds like this is what you're doing, is actually hire for potential versus hire based on experience.
Yes.
But it takes a lot for somebody to get their head around how to do that, especially a hiring manager who obviously needs to just hit revenue or tick a box of filling the gap, basically. And that's so hard, isn't it? I think it's how do you teach patience to say, actually, you could get this group of very strong females who might not necessarily fit the direct brief right now, but we can get them there.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's really interesting when I look at different phases of or types of recruitment. So for early careers, actually nailing the we need to hire for potential works, because of course the skills.
Yeah.
And even moving away from I have to have X degree, we've moved away from that years ago. So actually, I think we've got quite a robust, certainly at Barclays, we've got quite a robust potential model that we use and test for in early careers. But you're absolutely right. We kind of almost have then corporate amnesia when we get into kind of more senior hiring. So we're about to introduce Workday at Barclays in July globally, which is really exciting. And one of the things it will give us the opportunity to do is break down every single role we have and every single vacancy into skills. And then for all of our colleagues, they'll have the opportunity to share with us, and we'll bring some other inputs, the skills that they have, not just in the job they're in, but generally. And so suddenly having access to all of that information, I think, will help advance moving towards that skills-based hiring. But I agree with you. I've read a lot about this, but I've not seen anyone that's landed it consistently across all hiring types. I think that's the challenge for all of us.
Because there is a shortage, and it's not, I know that there are future gens that are coming through who are more involved in the science and the tech and the engineering roles, and that's great. We're a while off before we can bridge that senior gap. I think it's still not there.
You're right. Yeah.
So it's how unless people are kind of thinking about that, this kind of thing about the boardroom being mainly taken up by men that are called Dave is not going to change unless there is this change here around how we're looking at your senior hires and how you can think about that. But I for us, it's certainly an education piece around, we can help you match the skills, but you need to think a little bit more broadly in terms of them not ticking every single box on your job description.
Yeah. And I think it you know, there's a different type of diversity, isn't there, which is that diversity of thought. And I mean, I work in a heavily regulated industry where you absolutely do need to, in many roles, have that banking experience.
Yeah.
But we're also sort of challenging ourselves to say, actually, there are a number of roles where we think from a diversity perspective, it would be super helpful to bring in different industry experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, in the area of ESG, that's a big growth area for banking. But actually, there are other industries that have built those skills and are doing them in different ways. So I think we've also got to challenge ourselves more broadly with that diversity lens of, where do I bring in diversity of thought, not just assume because Sarah Grice has done banking for 20 years that the next Sarah Grice needs to have banking experience. So I think you're right. There's there's an element of patience, and then where do we challenge?
Yeah.
And that's what makes our jobs interesting, right?
Yeah, of course. And you've just segued into a piece that I do find really interesting. So I know financial services, there's elements of regulation that obviously in some roles you absolutely have to have, and I completely get that. But do you think there is a future where we are being a bit more transferable across sectors?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I think about this in a couple of different ways. So firstly, actually within a large organisation, where can you transfer people across the different verticals? So there's even that piece to start off with.
Yeah.
So, and even within HR, I'm a great example of someone that sat in that HR business partner verticals moved across, and therefore, guess what? I'm doing quite a lot of that in my own teams because I can see the benefits. But yeah, I mean, I think particularly, I mean, if I look at banking and I look at the technology and digital skills we need, that's a natural place to say, actually, we should really be fishing in a much broader pool to bring those skills in. Equally, one of the things that we look closely at Barclays and a number of banks do is, you know, how do you achieve absolutely excellent customer service? Again, there's a lot of different industries you can pull those skills from. Doesn't have to necessarily be banking. So I think you have to, I kind of call them talent corridors. You have to get really clear about where are those natural talent corridors, either within an organization or between, because it's not true to say everything can be cross industry and you do need some specialism. So if you can kind of narrow your focus, then I think that really helps the conversation, because you can go after those particular talent corridors.
Yeah, I like that term. I actually just made a note. I'm going to refer back to that because I really like that. That's a very cool term to think about. Sarah, we are nearing on the end of our time, but I've honestly learned so much already. And I do really appreciate you sharing these kind of tidbits, I guess, in terms of where people can just apply small quick learnings. I think obviously not quick in terms of how long they take to implement, because I think we both know from different experiences that patience is key in this situation. But you've had a lot of experience that shaped your career to date, and I would love to just think about, and you have shared a bit of advice at the beginning as well around networks and things, but thinking about the best bits of advice that we can share with the future generations that are coming up, but also people that are maybe struggling with certain points at the moment in their careers. What would you share?
Sure. So I guess if I could go back and talk to myself 20 odd years ago, what would I say? So we've talked about building your network and scaffolding, but make sure that within that you've got people that will challenge and push you as well as be your safe space. I think you kind of need both. Pulling out some of the things we talked about, I mean, recognize you don't need to know everything. You definitely don't need to have got it absolutely perfect. You don't need to have ticked everything on the job description for your next role before putting your hand up to learn and grow. There needs to, I always think, needs to be the right mix of, you know what, I've got this, I can do this, with, oh my goodness, that sounds interesting, but I've not experienced that before. You need to have the right mix. And then find ways to experiment. Sometimes I think we set ourselves these unrealistic, very binary, I'm all in or I'm not. But perhaps think about where you dip your toe in the water, try a project, take on that additional responsibility. Go join a network elsewhere and experiment if presenting is the thing that you want to do yeah. more of in a safer space, but experiment. So those would be probably a couple of things that I'd pull out that I wish I could have whispered in my own ear 20 odd years ago.
Yeah, it's always the way though, isn't it? We don't learn these things until we learn them the hard way, normally.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so, so much. Honestly, so much great sharing and learning there from your perspective across, as you say, the generalist HR mindset from transitioning then into more of a talent focus and now with the diversity lens as well. So thank you so much for sharing. I do have one final question because it is the Tea with TE podcast. Which is, how do you take your tea?
Goodness, that's the hardest question, I think. Firstly, let me just say I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. It's always, we never take this time out, do we, to reflect? And so no. I think it's really important. But my answer to your really killer question is it depends what time of day it is.
Okay.
So I'm a big kind of strong builder's tea in the morning, okay. just to, I guess, wake me up. By the afternoon, I definitely have to move into green tea zone, otherwise I can't sleep. But my absolute luxury, which I did do quite recently with some old friends, is to go out for a proper afternoon tea, indulge, drink lots of tea, perhaps a bit of champagne, eat some nice cake, and importantly, catch up on lots of gossip. That's my favourite type of tea.
Do you have a favourite place for your afternoon tea?
Well, I sound like I do lots of it. I don't. And this sounds very decadent. But myself and actually three old colleagues, we've worked with each other over many years, aww, took ourselves off to Fortnum & Mason just before Christmas.
Lovely.
And it was the best afternoon. And there were some great people watching as well.
Amazing. I've not actually tried the Fortnum one yet, so I'll have to add it to the list. I'm off excellent. To the Corinthia next week, actually, to try theirs so I can let you know and report back.
Lovely.
Yes. Sarah, thank you so much. Honestly, such a great session. I think so much that people will learn and really appreciate you taking time out.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it.